I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This is the first of several takes on Cuba, the Cuban Revolution in transition, the magic and mystique of Cuba, yesterday, today, still powerfully unfolding. Our guest, Patrick Sims, has written a marvel of literary journalism about Cuba. His hook was Fidel Castro's Jesuit prep school in Cuba's second city, Santiago de Cuba. And so the title, The Boys from Dolores. Dolores, which had been Desi Arnaz's high school, was a bastion of the high middle class that Fidel's revolution 50 years ago turned upside down. But the formation of the boy Fidel, the dormitory stories and fistfights, are just the opening frame in this book for hundreds of stories about Cuba and the Castros, then and now, by a writer who went back 11 times over a decade and under the radar took it all in and made almost a novel about it. The Boys from Dolores made the New York Times' list of the 10 best books of last year. It's fresh again on Fidel Castro's formal retirement last month. Patrick Sims, I love this book, and I'm thrilled to engage you on Open Source.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I got to say, every page in this book fires up the notion that something like the nth degree of charisma attaches to Cubans and to Cuba, almost enough to drive strong men around the bend. What is it? What is this secret?
Well, that's true. I think every page of that book is on fire because Cuba is, you know, it was built to drive us crazy. It is a beautiful paradise island in the middle of the sea. Like every island, it's self-contained. It's a place to project our fantasies. Christopher Columbus was the first one. He completely deceived himself about Cuba. He was convinced he was in China. He was go on and on to the King of Spain about how fantastic it was, and he didn't even see what he was talking about. And that's the Columbus syndrome. People come and they fall in love and it's, you know, a refuge for our fantasies. And I think that there's a long history. Cubans themselves are great dreamers and schemers and believe themselves, maybe rightly, to be distinct from all other islands in the Caribbean, all other cultures. It's much larger, much more dynamic society, half the landmass, a third of the people of the Caribbean. This isn't some little tiny isolated island. This was a vast, thriving, strong economic and political power that went into a phase that really just captured one of the crucial conflicts of the 20th century. Cuba became a sort of a touchstone, a symbol of the Cold War and the rise of the Third World. So it became a place for projection of those fantasies as well. Mm-hmm. And whether you're Cuban or an outsider, Cuba has always been and still is a place for that kind of fantasy.
A huge international city from way, way back, and now it's the sort of touchstone of a diaspora people. I mean, they're all over the world, and they're happy to tell you how special they are in a certain way, or how unhappy, or how driven, or something they are. What is it?
It is an element of tragedy, I think, that something that existed up until 1959 with all its corruption and the terrible things that happened in that pre-revolutionary regime, that world split apart. It was fragmented and shattered. So you have not only the exiles who went everywhere from, of course, Miami, but New York City, New Jersey, England, Germany, everywhere. I've heard about Cubans in the heart of Africa and Australia. They're all over the world. So you have not only those exiles who see that they left behind a world and therefore they fetishize it a little bit and cherish it and recreate it in mythology and storytelling, but you also have what Cubans call the inziles, the inzilio. And those are people who may still physically be inside Cuba, but they are mentally in a kind of internal exile. They have lost the world they came from. It's typically older people who remember the pre-revolutionary life. You often see among the boys from Dolores, there were quite a few. You know, they were from the professional classes. They were trained to be engineers, doctors, lawyers, and to go on and play a prominent role in a Cuba which turned out not to exist. So they have been left behind, sort of frozen in amber. And that sense of melancholy, you know, Cuba is one of the happiest places in the world, dancing and singing and wonderful music and great joy in the streets and tremendous familial warmth, everyone sort of sticking together and working together. But that's all deeply rooted, I think, in this sense of melancholy. I find it a very sad place as well. And it's quite – it was confusing for me until I grew up enough to realize that tragedy and joy are inextricably linked.
One of your old boys from Dolores, a remarkable writer named Lundy Aguilar, who ended up teaching for many years at Georgetown University in Washington, of all places. The mood was on him one day, and he wrote this extraordinary thing that you quote, called The Prophet. But he had a sort of warning about Cubans, and it ends remarkably like this. He says, "Don't argue with them ever. Cubans are born inherently wise. They don't need to read. They know everything. They don't need to travel. They have seen everything. The Cubans are the chosen people, chosen by themselves. They pass among lesser people like a ghost passing over water. Cubans are characterized individually by their sympathy and intelligence, and as a group by their shouting and passion. Every one of them carries the spark of genius, and no geniuses are tolerated. That's why it's easy to reunite Cubans and impossible to unite them." Lundy could write.
He was a true intellectual, and he saw these things not just as abstract cultural phenomena, but in the context of what was happening politically in Cuba. He was not just interested in The Prophet, and in this piece he was kind of paralleling or inspired by Khalil Gibran's work, The Prophet, and parodying it a little bit, but really just sticking a knife into his fellow Cubans in a very witty way. And he knew that something was coming in Cuba, that the end was coming. He saw it before others did because he was a true historian and an intellectual trained by those Jesuits. And he, in his exile, when he did go into exile because of the things he wrote, he was pushed into exile. As you mentioned, he went to Georgetown University as a professor there for 30 years. And of course, one of his students was Bill Clinton, who in his very large autobiography says Lundy Aguilar was his number one favorite professor, which is quite a tribute and a very lively guy. And unfortunately, you know, this many things in Cuba are coming to an end now, including many members of this generation. And Lundy Aguilar passed away just a few weeks ago after a long battle in ill health. And he's not the only one who's battling with ill health from that group of boys who were all together in, you know, 1942.
Question is, though, how much of that extraordinary quality survives in Cuba? I mean, and is the yeast of what's coming next in Cuba, do you think?
Well, it's, you know, the genius for improvisation and resolving problems has been pushed to the limit in Cuba because there are so many problems. Survival on a day-to-day basis requires every kind of invention. You know, the symbol of that is the old American car, which, right, you know, you ride around in these things. They
the
look
last
beautiful
Pontiac
from the outside. Yeah. You know, the Buick 8. And they rumble down the road and you sort of get in one thinking, oh, my God, look at this old beautiful car. This is going to be amazing. And you're in the inside and it reeks of diesel. And, you know, they've ripped out the engine and replaced it with a Soviet tractor engine. They punched a hole in the floor and put in a stick shift. You know, they've replaced the old AM radio with an 8-track, which is high technology in Cuba. And the thing doesn't get up above 25 miles an hour. And yet they keep it going. They keep it running. They do whatever they can. They are the genius mechanics. I've seen people literally in their garages making small foundries to pour, you know, metal parts themselves. So that kind of That yeast, as you call it, of inventiveness, I think, is definitely there. And you see it – there's only a few areas now where Cubans within the island can truly excel. Sports typically, which they do very disproportionately well on a global level. Cultural fields like baseball. But in the Olympics, they just bring home more gold medals than almost any small country. Boxing and so on. But, you know, and the arts are very lively. And, of course, music, where Cuba is a world beater and has been for a long time. But – that has not been diminished. Indeed, I think those things are enhanced during times of struggle and strife when people find there are a few other ways to express themselves. Music becomes so vital and so crucial to who people are.
Lundy reminds me that there's a kind of prophetic thread throughout this whole book and maybe through the whole people. And there were prophecies early on about Fidel. I'm sure there are prophecies today, you know, post-Fidel. The one that sticks in my mind, you refer to him as a mulatto gardener in Santiago someplace who read the future under Fidel like a – well, like a Delphic oracle. Remind us, and where does that come from?
Well, Cuba is has a culture of storytelling, and partly that's because they haven't lost. Every place is to be a storytelling culture, but Cubans, they don't have the distractions and the other forms of entertainment. They don't have 125 channels of television. If you turn on the radio, it's mostly state announcements. So what people do is they make music and tell stories, and it's still very important to have that tradition the horse sense, the common wisdom of people, the jokes and the stories, what they call in Cuba radio bemba, which I've heard that translated as lip radio. It means gossip, what we'd say on the grapevine, the street chatter, what people are saying. And it's still an oral culture. And that story about the gardener was one Lundy Aguilar told me, where he, like most Cuban exiles, he inevitably looked back for a moment when the evidence became clear, when the story of what was about to happen first occurred to him. And it was the gardener who told him, of all people, Lundy Aguilar, a historian, a journalist, educated, political man. He thought he knew what was going on. And he went to a friend's house, and the rebels had just taken power, and the country was in this elated mood, a so-called golden era. And Lundy was walking along whistling to himself and celebrating. He got to his friend's house, and the gardener looked at him and said, "Why are you celebrating, Professor? These boys only know the whip. This is going to be a government of the whip." And Lundy Aguilar told me that story, and he said it never really occurred to him at that point. And, it can't be. That's just the opposite of what we're all talking about. We're talking about democracy, and Castro promised open elections and restoration of the Constitution and the rule of law. How can you say that? And he didn't believe it. But every Cuban, I think, has a story of that prophetic moment. And it's particular to those who lost the island that they must look back all the time, so that the classic Miami exile lives in a bath of warm nostalgia all the time, thinking about who was it who said that. And after Lundy Aguilar told me about his prophet, I began to notice that every Cuban I interviewed had that story. It wasn't the gardener. It was somebody else.
Well, the guy with the story that trumps all in your book, if I may say, and I'd love you to just tell it, is that of a man named Jose Antonio Cubeñas, who was in high school with Fidel and was there when Fidel threw his bat at another kid. And in a certain sense, the whole story unfolds out of that.
I kept hearing about this, and it took a long time to track down Jose Antonio Cubeñas. And he was,
You tracked him down in Washington Heights in New York, as I remember.
Right, in New York City. It turned out he was only a subway ride away. I looked all over the world for him and just had to take the A train uptown. And I finally went to see him and confirmed the story that everyone else remembered, which is they were on a lunch break. And Fidel Castro and Jose Antonio Cubeñas were pretty close. They were both from the countryside and were boarding students at the school, which is a small minority. So they slept right next to each other in different rooms and knew each other pretty well. And were kind of rivals in some ways, but friends. And they had a stickball game at lunch, and it went wrong, and Castro struck out. And if you play stickball, it's not that hard to hit the ball. It's pretty rare to strike out in stickball. And so the boys cracked up laughing and were teasing Fidel. And he, in a fit, he threw the bat at them. And it struck one of the boys and either dislocated or broke his shoulder, depending on who's telling the story. And out of some sense of leadership, Jose Antonio Cubeñas challenged Fidel Castro, who was down in the patio below him. And he called down to him and he said, "You beast! You bestia! Animal!" And Fidel challenged him and said, "This is none of your business. Stay out of it." And Cubeñas, these boys, they're 15 years old at this point, or 14 years old. And Cubeñas said to him, "Are you coming down there or am I coming up here?" And it just escalated. And indeed, showing a great deal of mettle, the young Fidel did come up here. He went to the stairs and slowly marched up right into Jose Antonio Cubeñas's face. And bam, they went at it, fist fighting, throwing punches, ended up down on the ground. Cubeñas on top, flailing away at him, Fidel underneath, flailing up. And it was broken up by one of the priests. It didn't last long, but, for boys, these sorts of things are very memorable, and a fist fight is always exciting, and everyone talked about it. And this story had a great significance to Cubeñas, not only because he's one of the few men who can claim to have punched Fidel Castro in the nose, but because he saw the reaction that Fidel had, which was pretty strong. It was to leave the school. Fidel transferred. He went to another school. And according to Cubeñas and some of the other boys from Dolores, that was because he couldn't stand to see the look on the faces of the other boys when Fidel was beaten. He couldn't stand to be number two. He couldn't stand to be defeated in front of other people. He had to be – he was driven always to be, as a very young boy, competitive, excellent, you know, sobresaliente, as they say in Cuba, beyond excellent, and to be the leader and to be top. And suddenly he was no longer in that position in this small school. And maybe there were other reasons he left the school, but I do think it captures something about that young Fidel, that ambition, that burning desire to be the biggest fish in the biggest pond. And he never thereafter, although Cubeñas and he remained close, they never really trusted each other again.
And Cubeñas sort of put the mark on him, and it stuck. I think it was he in your book who called him a dominator, but a man, a young man from the beginning, who was strong enough to fight when cornered, but also weak enough to pick on the weak.
Yeah. Cubeñas called him a bully, a natural bully, somebody who wanted to dominate but was inside, he said, even a coward. Now, that's not a word you can use lightly with Fidel Castro, who proved later to have physical courage and so on. But remember that Cubeñas actually spoke those words not with condemnation but with a kind of fear. I found that he was still – you know, at this point the man was in his 70s sitting in an apartment in New York City and he was still afraid of Fidel Castro. When he answered the phone, he didn't want to talk to me. Who are you? Why are you calling? How did you get this number? You know, he's afraid. The government is listening to my phone calls. I said to him, well, which government? It didn't matter. Cubans, Americans, who could tell? Mm-hmm. He lived in this world where the great power of Fidel Castro was manifest, even starting in that moment in childhood. And of course, as the revolution took over, you know, it was like your worst nightmare coming true for somebody like José Antonio Cubeñas, and for many of these boys to see their whole world destroyed by this kid who had been sort of a tough at the school, also an excellent student. We shouldn't sell Castro short. He was one of the, you know, a legend already at the time he was at the school. He was a superb student, famous. Cubeñas said what he had was memory, just a tremendous drive to memorize and learn, reading all the time.
Yeah, he said later
in the morning with a book.
You quote him saying if he'd had it to do over again, he'd have been a better student. But you say that was pure nonsense because he was about as good as a student could be.
Yeah, and put in more hours than a student could put and volunteered for every activity from every sports team to the hikes in the mountains. Just a relentless kid, a tremendous drive. You know, by the time he got to Dolores, this was already long established. In Castro almost never has spoken about his childhood, and in the few comments he's made, he describes himself by the age of eight as being a stubborn, driven boy determined to rise to the top. You know, and by the time he was 12, demanding to be enrolled in Dolores because it was the best school in Santiago, and he acknowledges in these very pompous statements that are posted on the wall of that school today. It still exists. It's still a school, and if you go in there, there's a little tiny museum, and on the wall, you know, Castro is quoted acknowledging that only when he arrived at Dolores did he find that there were finally some teachers who were worthy of his studying under. So he had quite a fierce drive and opinion of himself.
Patrick Sims, there are so many extraordinary witnesses in this book, and a lot of them of the younger generations too. We'll get to them. But just as a token of the fact that you listened to both sides in great depth, I wish you'd speak of the De Jong brothers, partly because, well, there were three of them, but David in Florida and Kiki in Havana have barely spoken to each other in many decades, and see the history of the Cuban Revolution almost exactly opposite.
They were, fascinating and emblematic to me. I had been searching for them without quite knowing it because this is a story about Cuba and therefore it's a story about divisions, an island that was ripped apart, a school that was ripped apart. And I knew somewhere there had to be a family, of course, that was ripped apart by this, and that became the De Jongs. Kiki De Jong, the youngest brother, stayed behind in Cuba, which is rare for the boys from Dolores. Most of them went into exile. And he was almost unique in being a ongoing and passionate believer in the revolution, a very intellectual defender of it. And I, through an amazing set of happenstance and research and good luck managed to find him in Havana and interview him. And he said, well, you know, my brothers live in Miami. So later when I left, I went to Miami and looked up his older brothers. The oldest is David, and then the middle brother was Arturo. And they just couldn't be more different in their opinions. These are three apples that fell in three different directions. Mm. You know, Kiki, the youngest, was a sort of intellectual, very – I have to say he really challenged me on my sort of analysis of Cuban history and asked me some questions that I was never able to answer. You know, he said, isn't it necessary? Well, I said to him, you know, look, this revolution has done many bad things. It's done, how can you – you know, support a revolution that has crushed civil rights, crushed democratic reforms. And he said to me, what did you expect? A revolution has to be hard. It's not a simple thing. It is the overturning of an entire society. Of course it was hard and difficult and violent. And, you know, what did you expect, Patricio? That's what he said to me. And I left that night saying, you know, I can't quite believe it was necessary, but certainly I think he is right that a revolution is inherently dangerous and difficult, and that is one of the lessons of the Cuban Revolution. There's no such thing as a nice smiley face revolution where we get to choose to have democracy after we have the revolution. No, it is a matter of force. And interestingly enough, his older brother, the oldest, David, is a very hardline exile of strong opinions, anti-Castro in the extreme. I finally sat down with him in his house in Miami, and he told me right off the bat that Castro was responsible for the September 11th attacks in the United States. And I was flabbergasted. I said, what are you talking about? He said, the hijackers trained in Florida, and Castro's agents control everything. You know, nothing moves in Florida without their knowing about it. And to him, this worldview made perfect sense, where Fidel Castro was powerful, almost omnipotent, and deeply evil. And he was proud of that. In fact, although I let him speak in my book and promote some of these outrageous theories of his, he nonetheless showed up at my book reading in Miami and thanked me because he was, you know, he's proud of his opinions and proud to be anti-Castro, and was himself, a believer in violence. He was one of these men who really was determined to sabotage the revolution and was collecting guns and getting ready to participate in sabotage operations and was hoping to, you know, be part of a coup d'etat that would overthrow Castro. So you had this family that just fell out on all different sides. And, the middle brother, Arturo, a very quiet sort of, I don't want to say wounded, but a man who had avoided either extreme, as a middle brother might in these situations. And it was very striking to me to see that family divided so traumatically in every direction from itself. And Toulouse also, by the way, you know, they were, as they themselves admitted, they were a rich landowning, apartment building owning family with investments and gold and big houses and servants and cars in Cuba. And of course, all that was blown away. And the oldest brother, David DeYoung, who I found his political opinions pretty outrageous, but I have to say he was a true idealist in the sense that, like many Cuban exiles, he has no regrets about giving up and losing all that and getting out of Cuba. And he said, you know, I would give it all away 10 times over again in order to have the freedom that I have here in America. And he lives in a modest house. He doesn't have what he had when he was a kid, you know, the wealth and the status and so on. But he doesn't care about that. And he and his wife, she was just nodding her head saying, we would never, you know, choose to have those things over what we have here in this little house, which is our own house and our own freedom and our own lives. And it was very touching to hear that.
Patrick Sims, just locating yourself, for starters, among the boys from Dolores tilts the narrative in a certain way. I mean, these were children of the all-white elite that Fidel Castro rebelled against, and they were the revolution's first victims. They were expropriated. Most of them left. They're beyond bitter about what happened to not their property just, but their country. How balanced does your own judgment come out about the accomplishments of the revolution? You write movingly about the literacy campaigns, the success of huge public health drive over many years. You acknowledge the success of an independent sovereignty having gotten Spain out of there, they kept the United States out of there for 50 solid years. What's your score on the revolution?
Well, you know, I think you have to acknowledge, as the boys from Dolores do, they were trained by the Jesuits to acknowledge both sides of an argument, because that is the only understanding. You cannot be simply passionate and for or against. That's nonsense. It is a complex phenomenon. You have to see both sides. And I was quite struck. I went back and looked at one of the history textbooks that they actually used at Dolores, where the Jesuits would teach these boys to study Cuban history and Cuban relations with the United States, a very fraught subject. And they demanded that the boys defend the American position. That's not a natural thing to ask a Cuban schoolboy to do. They're patriotic and nationalistic. But it was to teach them that there were other arguments and you had to be prepared to defend both. That's why I acknowledge the literacy campaign, this tremendous transformative social effect in the revolution, where Cuba, in the course of 1 year, became one of the most literate nations in the world, a single year.
Yeah. And when the Bay of Pigs invaders came on shore, the literacy team took up guns for their country.
Because it was so idealistic. These, you know, 100,000 young people volunteered to go into the mountains to teach reading, volunteered to go to the beaches in southern Cuba, having no idea that one night an invasion force was going to come ashore. But the revolution tapped into this tremendous idealism. And I always think back to a conversation I had. And I should say I only had this conversation once or twice. But it is representative of a thread inside the revolution. I was in the streets of Havana more than 10 years ago and late at night, and I needed a taxi, and I held a dollar bill out in my hand. Mm-hmm. And a guy pulled over in a Lada and said, "Okay, where are you going?" And I named my hotel. And as we were driving along, he said he'd never met an American before, and we were talking about the revolution and started talking about politics, and it turned into this long conversation. And finally he said to me, and he was black, which is important, and he said, "My grandfather cut sugar cane for a living. My father cut sugar cane for a living. And I'm an electrical engineer, and that's because of the revolution. So I will always be for this revolution." And he acknowledged failures and weaknesses, and maybe his opinion has changed since 10 years ago. Most Cubans don't feel that way anymore. I think that's a very rare story, but it represents, it captures this tremendous positive social transformation that the revolution brought. Now, of course, crucially, that came at a huge price. Force, the monopoly on force, as Lundy Aguilar and other boys from Dolores saw and prophesied, this revolution would be a government of the whip. The first thing they did on coming to power, executions, show trials. They still have these Stalinistic show trials in Cuba just once every 10 years to set an example for people. Mm-hmm. It is a police state. It is deeply repressive. It is solely exists at this point in order to preserve the power of the people who run it, in my opinion. I think the only agenda left for the revolution is no surrender of our power. We've seen the transition from Fidel Castro to Raul Castro, which occurred as if a piece of private property were being handed along.
Right.
I think that the flaws of the revolution, you ask me how I score it, and I have to score those flaws very deeply. I have seen so many people ruined by the revolution, starved, beaten, arrested for speaking to me in the street. Many of my sources in Cuba have been put in jail for long periods, 7 years. One man I interviewed got 25 years in jail for his human rights activity. He was arrested a month after I spoke to him. He is out now because of health reasons, but that's, you know, the state is all powerful. The intelligence services are spread throughout the society. They do listen to your phone calls if you become active. You know, it's a relatively open society for the average person. You can say whatever you want as long as you don't say it into a microphone. So there is a sort of a hidden nature to that repression. But I find it everywhere, and it is ultimately the tragic legacy of the revolution, that early optimism and social reformation was thrown away.
Cuba is also very, very poor. The most middle-class community really in the Caribbean 50 years ago, and maybe for a long time, is now desperately poor. held up by Venezuela, perhaps. And it's, in your telling, a very unhappy place. Could we talk about the transition that's underway and where it's going?
Well, I don't think it really is a transition. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think the point of this transition so far has to prevent any changes. Raul Castro, when Fidel, his older brother, fell ill and more recently has repeated the same formulas, saying, oh, yes, we're ready for new ideas, and then shut down any discussion of new ideas. The first thing Raul did was announce, oh, yeah, well, you know, we're going to be open-minded about the future. And then he recentralized the economy and he eliminated many of the forms of self-employment that Cubans were allowed to have, which are the only people in Cuba who have any economic freedom are, you know, people who fix flat tires on bicycles. That's one of the few jobs you're allowed to have. And Raul literally made it illegal to be a birthday clown. You can no longer work as a clown at birthday parties. Only the state is allowed to supply clowns to birthday parties. So he has the same mania for control that his older brother has. And I think, you know, in a psychological sense, there is a very important transition occurring, which is people must now accept that there will be a Cuba after Fidel. That sounds very simple and obvious, but within Cuba, the propaganda is so intense that right before Castro fell ill, they actually announced in the state newspaper that he would probably live to 120. That was it. You know, they consulted the medical authorities. They gave him a workup and they said he's got every chance of making it to 120. That's what they were selling. That's the image, this tireless leader who can never die. And of course, he can die and will die someday. And it's vitally important that Cubans sort of escape this closed mental environment they're in where they can't see the horizon. They have no idea what's going on in the outside world or even within their own country. Often they're, I find, sort of tragically naive. You can have these sort of hushed conversations with people, as I've had over the last year during two long reporting trips around Cuba about the future. And they can be a little naive. You know, they'll tell you, oh, you know, I mean, within a year, everything will be worked out, right? I sort of have to say, well, you know, it might take a little more than a year. And they kind of imagine, oh, you know, the economy will suddenly improve. We'll all have jobs. We'll have nice houses like we see in America. And everything will be fine and all our troubles will be over. And in fact, I wonder that if it's possible that maybe their troubles are just beginning, that
but how can there be a dark period. How can there be anything like stability in a long succession here? You write in the book, Patrick Sims, there's no way to have Fidelism without a Fidel. You thought that whoever came next was to be pitied. But at another point you write, what new Cuba could be born from this rotten thing, this pile of crumbling expectations surrounded by vultures? You said it could spark a civil war. Cuba has fought itself before. Just what do you mean by a civil war, and what are the chances?
The chances are impossible to predict. I've only been going to Cuba for 15 years, so I call myself a beginner. All I do is think about the answer to that question, and I hope it tells you something that I do not know, the answer to that question. It is possible that there could be great violence in Cuba. I've talked to dissidents like Osvaldo Paya, one of the most important dissidents in Cuba, head of a democratic reform movement, who told me there's a built-up – you know, he's afraid. He said, you know, there's a lot of tension, a lot of desire for revenge and the settling of scores. And there are these wild elements, you know, what will happen with the Miami exiles? Will they try to come back? Will their children try to come back? How will the society that has been, at least rhetorically, deeply tied to the notion of exact equality, how will that fare in a world where, you know, the one thing I can guarantee you is they will not keep the exact equality, which is only a result of the force of the system now, where everyone is equally poor. When, as soon as somebody starts to make money, these differences will open up. What happens when drugs come into Cuba? Cocaine, the money associated with cocaine. How about adding 50 or 250 pistols from the Miami gun market? I think you will see some hard times ahead in Cuba. And I was interviewing dissidents all over the island about a year ago, and a woman in central Havana who was, you know, from a very poor small town – excuse me, central Cuba, a very poor small town. She I remember as, so deeply the way she followed me down the street in the middle of the night saying, we're going to suffer. We're going to suffer. And that sense of a dark cloud looming that most Cubans don't want to acknowledge. They would rather pretend that everything's going to be fine. And I suppose that's possible. Maybe there will be a velvet revolution, a euphoric moment, a kind of people's power where democracy springs up. That can happen. It's not impossible. But I don't see the United States or Cuba preparing for it. And that's why I think it's so important that even though Raul Castro is engaging in no actual transition or reforms or changes within Cuba, and he is not a liberal and he is not opening up the economy and he is not preparing the ground for the future, even so, the departure of Fidel Castro from the leadership means psychologically that that process has begun. And I'm told that, you know, the younger generation of people involved in the system inside the politics, inside the party, are beginning to reposition themselves and think about where Cuba, you know, 10 years from now, they're young, they're thinking 10, 20 years out, where am I going to be? And they need to be prepared for something different.
But positioning themselves how, Patrick? Could I just say parenthetically, you recount some horror stories of the sort of totalitarian spirit at work about black committees of the revolution, punishing a poet, for example. A poet had written – a woman, she had written, "I don't believe in slogans like fatherland or death," a kind of parody of Fidel at his worst. And she was severely humiliated by her own neighbors.
Yeah, yeah. Maria Elena Cruz Varela, she was literally forced to eat her own words. They – block committees, which always operate under the control of – the counterintelligence system and at its inspiration, you know, denounced her, beat her up and tore up her poems and literally shoved them down her throat. Many of the people get that kind of – you know, it's only the most best-known dissidents and activists would get that treatment. The average Cuban would never face that sort of violence. But it only takes a few examples to set the tone for society.
Patrick, I just wondered, reading it, you know, take the Castro brothers away – what is the Cuban population's attachment to that sort of bad parody of Marxist-Leninist party line, party discipline ugliness?
Well, a society, every society includes people who find their home in the system. So, you know, there are the Communist Party is 7.5% of Cubans, and in that group there are many who – you know, or loyalists who for all sorts of personal reasons think that this is the thing to do and to be – support the government and to join the bloc committees and denounce the traitors. But, you know, Cubans are naturally disputatious and fall on all sides of this. So, you know, dissidents told me about, you know, being approached by people and, you know, even some in relative positions inside the system, you know, asking for books, asking for to talk about what could happen in the future. And that's how they're positioning themselves or thinking about the future. But I think there's always an element. You know, I talked to a psychologist who's a dissident in Santa Clara in eastern Cuba, central Cuba, and he said, you know, these people, there's just a – you know, every society produces those who want to be accommodated, who want to get along with the system and who see their future in it. It's their jobs. It's how people make a living. It's how you get your privileges. It's how you get your food. You know, it's how you get your vacation is by being a loyalist and doing what you're supposed to do and attending the rallies. So that system, you know, it has its – true believers and then a class of people who accommodate themselves to it. And then naturally there are many people. I found a lot of the dissidents, they're just stubborn. They're people who, you know, almost out of personal character, out of personal things that happened to them, frustrations, a relative who was arrested. They, you know, they didn't need to read Thomas Jefferson to learn about democracy. They just didn't like what was happening to them. And they reacted out of a personal sense of outrage. And, you know, there is always – every population always has those stubborn people. And they are going to decide the day, I think, more than the accommodationists who will see their system disappear one day. And everyone will say, oh, I was never part of any acts of repression. And the people who were stubborn – one of the dissidents told me, I said, well, what's going to happen after the transition? He said, well, I'll still be in opposition because that's what he does. That's – you know, he's against to the political class. And when democracy comes, he said, I'll be against that as well. Not against democracy, but against, you know, the corrupt politicians who come along. So it's a phenomenon almost of demographics.
Patrick Sims is our guest. We're talking about Cuba. You just started to mention U.S. and Cuban preparations for not only a real transition, but a different relationship. Where are we, Patrick?
Oh, we're in a grim situation. There's a official U.S. government committee on the transition in Cuba, and I'm sure they're going to handle it just as well as they handled the law and order in Baghdad and a thousand other projects of the U.S. government. I think the best thing we could do for a transition is go find that U.S. government commission and dump their filing cabinets in the Potomac. Everybody's got a different plan. You know, there is no agreement within Cuba or outside of Cuba. I think that, you know, right now the U.S. government is carefully avoiding doing anything to prepare for a new Cuba. The embargo that exists, although it's actually a very weak embargo and has, I argue, a very small effect on Cuba. It's more a legend than an embargo.
Right.
But it is,
you say there are a lot of agricultural and other exceptions for
It's all loopholes, as far as I can tell. It exists merely as a psychological phenomenon, a statement of hostility. And instead, you know, I think we would do much better if we ignored the government and, you know, tried to just open up a flood of normal relations with Cuba, not in order to bolster the revolution, but so as to bolster the Cuban people. But that's not happening. That's not politically savvy in the United States. It's not how you get the votes in Florida. So we are trapped in a situation in which both sides are – Washington and Havana are conspiring to pretend that there's this very severe blockade and hostile policy, and it's all kind of a show. But it does prevent us from coming to grips. You know, why did George Bush cut down on cultural exchanges with Cuba, the sending of professors to Cuba and to deal with Cubans? We should be opening those contacts and trying to let a little air into Cuba. And also we need to look frankly at the role of the U.S. in Cuban history, which has been very destructive. I think the less the United States does to involve itself in Cuba, the more successful we will be in seeing our national interest represented, which is a democratic and stable Cuba. The United States has been the villain in Cuban history. We did try to assassinate Castro many times. We did, you know, ship arms to the military dictatorships and put some of those men in power in the 1930s and 20s. So the United States needs to change its policy, but I don't see the slightest chance of that happening.
You know, I was going to say, and you said it well, that maybe the strongest impression of your book, Patrick, is that the United States and Cuba over many generations now have brought out the worst in themselves and each other. It may be simple geography. It may be temperament. It may be habit. Among other symptoms, corruption and profiteering and phony elections, self-dealing, hypocrisy, you list them all and the history is there. Where would you start making a different formal path here?
Well, I think that there's going to be an opportunity. You know, the formal track is determined in Washington. It's a result of congressional politics and looking for votes in New Jersey and Miami and that won't change until Fidel dies, I think, even if Raul is still in power. Fidel Castro actually goes into his grave. I think you could see a shift in congressional politics in the United States. This is really an expression of an attitude, you know, the U.S. hostility to Cuba, an attitude that comes out of Miami Cubans who want to punish Castro. Unfortunately, this has backfired. After 40 years, the embargo has had the opposite effect. It has become the justification for everything within Cuba. The regime in Cuba exists today because of its ability to blame the United States for everything that happens. The joke is, you know, if a light bulb goes out in Cardenas, Fidel says, "You see what they do to us?" And that is the prop holding up the government now, hostility of the United States, constant announcements of that hostility. And unfortunately, George Bush has played into that. Perhaps there is a united stand with European governments. If our policy with, you know, was not just our policy, you've got sort of three tracks, the Cuban policy, the United States policy, and then the European policy, which is somewhere in the middle. If that could be united, if we could get on the same page and the entire world were speaking to Cuba with one voice, then I think diplomacy could have an effect. Right now, you know, no outside players can really influence Cuba. I don't think that Raul Castro will be pried out of power, even with a crowbar.
Can you imagine symbolic beginnings under a new president, whoever it is?
Yeah, I think we should have baseball.
I was just going to say, how about sports?
Yeah, let's send the Orioles back down there. That was great, you know. I think we need to open a psychological door with Cuba. Maybe it's music. Maybe it's artists and sports. Why not baseball? Why not a major league, you know, spring training session in Havana?
How about an Arturo Sandoval, Paquito Rivera, Chucho Valdez music festival shuttling between Miami and Havana?
Ah, but then, see, you can't take the politics out of anything because isn't some of those guys, Paquito de Rivera, a lot of those guys are quite hostile to Castro and his work. They're exiles.
Of course.
So, you know, I've often dreamed, couldn't we have like a big, you know, rock festival in Havana and say, let's set aside politics for a day and just have human-to-human contact. But that can't happen in Cuba. Everything is politicized both by the Cuban government and by the United States. You know, taking the partisan politics out of this feud, this is a family feud. This is a knife fight. Nobody's going to sit as a smile. Oh, let's hug. You know, you and I may feel like that. And a lot of ordinary Cubans just love America. It's one of the most startling things when you go around the streets of Havana and people are so excited to hear you from America. And it's, you know, one of the last places in the world where you see huge numbers of people just eager to dress up in American flags, to put American flags on their cars and on the windows of their houses and to sort of, you know, every expression of Americanness is just the ultimate chic gesture in Cuba and people love it. And it's quite startling given the opinion of the United States and many other countries. So there is great potential there for warmth and contact. And, you know, given the troubled past, I think we do need almost at a cultural level to sort of stand back. But I don't see that happening. I think, you know, you're going to see once it becomes possible for American corporations to invest in Cuba directly, what do you think is going to happen? Well, they're going to start building condos and hotels and fast as they can to make as much money as they can. And guess what? Cubans want to make money. They're especially young Cubans. They're fed up. They've been deprived of everything their whole lives. They want to catch up with the world. And so I think you'll see, you know, a kind of a mad rush to exploit everything and develop everything. And it's going to be a very shockingly different Cuba.
First off, everybody should read your book, and then maybe they should all go to Havana. There's so much good writing under your name, Patrick. I want to read just a part of a paragraph about Havana. In the middle of your book, you say, "Havana, I loved the capital bitterly and deeply, an unrequited love made possible only by distance and loss. The luminous blue-gray hurricane light, the storm spray that left cars, people, and decaying mansions coated with the white dust of salt, the oily harbor fuming and ringed with Spanish forts, the blue streak of the Gulf Stream itself visible from the rooftops every day, a world just beyond. Even storm waves broke against this indestructible city." You say life was in ruins in this triumphant city and always had been.
I you know, I have a friend who's a photographer, and I was telling him my impressions of Havana and how decayed everything was. And he said, "Wait a minute." And he went over to his table, and he had a book of photographs of Havana by Edward Weston in the 1930s, late 20s and early 30s. And it looks just like today. I was shocked. I thought, oh, you know, it's typical. I was like, oh, look what Castro did to that city. And then you look at these photos and you say, oh, I see. Wait a minute. It was always like this. So Castro has done his part to remove a lot of the glory from Havana, but it was always this sort of hard-pressed, battered city. I think, you know, it was likewise, it's for 400 years, you know, it was the headquarters of the Spanish fleet in the Americas, a kind of a giant, rollicking party town with whorehouses everywhere, and that's, you know, what it still is today. It's one of the sex tourism capitals of the world. It is a debauched and tragic city. I talk in there in the book about, you know, everybody gets away with everything, even though you could be arrested for anything. Mm-hmm. Almost everything is illegal in Cuba, yet, you know, I've seen some of the most depraved scenes of my life in Havana and people getting away with just about anything. And it's, you know, that is an element, a sort of a tragic element that, you know, there was no golden age. There was no nostalgic perfect time back in Cuba. If you talk to exiles, I describe David DeYoung's wife, who was quite a good amateur painter, and she'd make these beautiful paintings like many Cuban exiles, beautiful sunset, hills covered with palm trees, blue water with gentle little waves on it, you know, a little boat, as if that was what reality was like. It was never like that.
You have a way with prophets, Patrick Sims. Do you have a favorite prophet about the road ahead?
Well, I think I am ready to step into the role. I have a prediction.
Okay.
I think three things are going to happen in Cuba. In the short term, Raul Castro is going to give a speech saying that everything will change, and actually nothing will change. Fidel Castro will die in the medium term, and he will have the largest and most emotional funeral in the history of Latin America. I expect to see millions of people lining the road down the middle of Cuba, tears streaming down their faces. Even his enemies will be crying, and they'll roll him back down central Cuba to his grave in eastern Cuba next to Jose Marti in the Santiago Cemetery. And then in the long run, I think things will begin to change, and Cuba will lose its unique place in this world as an island out of time. It will re-enter the mainstream of life. And how that plays out and how it, whether it's violent or confrontational or whether it becomes like the old Cuban politics with, you know, political gangs running around Havana shooting at each other, or whether it's a velvet revolution and everyone's all smiles and opening champagne bottles, I can't tell you. But in the end, Cuba will reassert itself and will continue on. And that character of the people, that vibrancy, that love of life, that sense of a passion that is almost unable to accept the passion of others, that's almost an intolerant passion, that's so happy with its own passion that it cannot tolerate others or agree with anyone else, that will reassert itself too. Cubans will keep arguing. They'll keep fighting. They'll keep being in opposition, as that dissident said to me. When the democracy comes, I'll still be in opposition. That's my prediction for the future of Cuba.
Patrick Sims, you talk good. You write good. Thank you so much for The Boys from Dolores, and thank you for joining us on Open Source.
Thank you, Christopher.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Please have at this ongoing conversation about Cuba today and tomorrow at our website, www.radioopensource. Write me directly, if you like, in an email to chris@radioopensource.org. And thank you for being part of the community of the curious and the conversational at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Till the next round.